Sheppy. The siege. The newsroom was very busy when a resident of the Isle of Sheppy in North Kent called to say that there was breaking news on the isle.
That is all she said, no more, just breaking news, which was as far as she got before there was a muffled cry which was clearly audible in the receiver and the phone went dead. The person who had taken the call, Dixie the Digger Malone, was the Daily Magnet's ace reporter. She was always looking to break big news stories.
She thought there were enough strange elements in this call to prick her interest. It seemed that something big was developing.
Without consulting her editor, she was off. She went bounding down the stairs to the carpool where she selected her favorite, the drophead coupe, painted brilliant red.
There was nothing subtle about Dixie. She could never be described as a shrinking violet.
Making her way out of London as speedily as she could, this was, admittedly, not very fast. The present emergency had kept many off the roads. The traffic on the eastbound carriageway was dreadful. Many vehicles were heading, as quickly as they could, away from the nightmare that London had become.
They were all heading in the one direction, out of town. There were few vehicles travelling on the adjacent carriageway going toward London.
Dixie went through the Blackwall Tunnel with not too much trouble. The traffic was heavy on the A2 out of London but still moving, after a fashion. She made reasonable speed until reaching the exit road for the M25 where all lanes had come to a grinding halt.
It took fully 2 hours to clear this hurdle.
The jam had been caused by the sheer volume of traffic wanting to join the M25 or exit from the other side onto the A2. Dixie was able to move at a more reasonable speed once this bottleneck had been negotiated. She then began to reflect about the phone call that had caused her rush to the coast and the call's abrupt ending. This was something she would need to investigate in its own right and, if possible, in some detail once she got to Sheppy.
Now, she was cruising along the A2 at a steady pace.
The signpost for Gravesend immediately caught her attention. Perhaps it was prophetic. Dixie believed in the supernatural, so the sign might be a portent of the future. Passing Junction 4 on the M2, the flow of traffic came to a grinding halt. Dixie wished she had diverted and continued on the A2, but that was probably just as clogged. Anyhow, it was wishful thinking at this juncture, and she needed to think quickly as to her next move. Dixie, always resourceful, turned her mind to thinking about how she could continue her mission. Just then she heard the roar of a motorbike approaching. Deftly, for one who was not so young, she jumped onto the grass verge to let the bike pass, but to Dixie's surprise the bike stopped.
The rider proved to be none other than Ricky Otter, the news office gopher.
Ricky, in his leisure time, was a part-time TT racer.
He was not long back from a holiday on the Isle of Man.
Ricky explained that the Daily Magnet's owner, Rupert Maxwell, had heard that she had rushed out of the office hoping to scoop a story. He had found out where she was heading by activating the fitted pool car tracker.
All the Daily Magnet's pool cars had these devices fitted.
After a quick discussion with Ricky, they decided that the best option would be to continue the mission together.
This would please Rupert Maxwell, who had a soft spot for Dixie. Leaping onto the motorbike, with Dixie on the pillion, they were aware that they could not afford to lose more time.
They sped off along the M2, reaching Junction 5 in a few minutes.
Here they took the slip road onto the A249.
This would take them directly to the Sheppy Bridges, although, they suspected that the lift bridge would have been permanently disabled.
They had no information as to the condition of the principal road bridge.
Slowly weaving in and out of the stationary cars, camper vans, lorries and pedestrians, in all shapes and sizes, they eventually came to the foot of the bridge. What an extraordinary sight met their eyes.
The first barrier to the bridge was a full 100 yards from where the bridge actually started.
This was a trench dug across both carriageways and across the adjacent fields curving back, at the far edges, to the river. This trench was manned by what we were quickly told were the Sheppy Defence Volunteers, the SDV, a hastily put together cohort of local activists determined to ensure there was no access to the isle from the mainland. The locals were frightened of all the diseases incomers might carry. The SDV were dressed in an assortment of clothing but nothing resembling a uniform. A few had battle dresses and camouflage coats, and some wore SDV armbands with a picture of Saint Sexburger above the letters. As for weapons, bows and arrows, crossbows, shotguns, Blunderbusses and old fouling pieces seemed to be in the majority, but there was the odd trench mortar interspersed. We both wondered where these had come from, but for the moment these weapons allowed the defenders to hold on. Edging the motorbike closer to the front of the crowded road, through groups of very angry people. The pair managed to find a person with a loud hailer who had been shouting insults at the plucky defenders. To his great surprise, Dixie grabbed it from him and shouted that they were reporters from the Daily Magnet.
She wanted to speak with the person in charge. Having heard the magic words, Daily Magnet, the defense line was guardedly opened and the two were ushered quickly through.
They were shortly speaking with the bridge commander, Major, retired, Algernon Sloper, more commonly known to his volunteers as Ali Sloper. Ali gave to Dixie and Ricky an outline of the defense strategy, pointing out that, as suspected by the pair, the lift bridge had been raised and disabled so there was no chance of the mainland invaders being able to use it to cross. The Major also mentioned that Barrow Hill, just to the north, was being fortified.
There was a Sheppy Navy in being, although he knew little about it.
It was based in two locations on the Isle, Queenborough at Harty Ferry. Seeing, in the corner of his eye, the end piece of some rope which was dangling over the side of the bridge, Ricky went to investigate. What he found was curious. There seemed to be some waterlogged, wooden cases strapped to the underside with some lettering.
There was a word printed on the case, but he could only make out a few faded letters. These letters seemed to be ONT.
Before he could ask about this, there was a ragged volley of shots heard from the defense line, plus arrows whizzing into the air.
The pair were hurried to their motorbike and off the bridge.
Ali had given Dixie a safe conduct pass for them both. They could see activity on Barrow Hill and yet, more curiously, a plume of smoke to the rear of it.
They decided, though, to head for Queenborough but made a mental note to investigate this later.
Coming off the bridge, they could see a large distribution warehouse on the left, and, a little beyond that, a superstore. Both buildings had big signs outside reading, "No toilet paper."
Not surprising really, as there had been no deliveries of anything for a few weeks. Food stocks were probably decreasing also. Speeding past the superstore and continuing straight ahead to the T-junction, where the Norman Castle had once stood, Ricky turned left and headed for the Queenborough waterfront. The Queenborough waterfront was crowded with people milling around. Some were spectators, some were wheeler dealers, and some were Sheppy Defense volunteers, Marine Corps. There was the same assortment of uniforms as seen on the bridge. Here, though, most had a nautical theme.
Some were wearing dark blue berets, usually with some kind of cap badge, known among mariners as a steaming bonnet, that is for wearing when a vessel is at sea.
Others had found some bell-bottom trousers.
Out of the bottom drawer, no doubt, they had probably not seen the light of day since the 1970s. Out of this melee stepped a well-dressed individual, complete with blue blazer, white flannels and yachting pumps. To finish the naval officer impression, on his head, he had a Prince Heinrich cap at a jaunty angle. He introduced himself as Commodore William Barnacle, usually known as Barnacle Bill. Barnacle started to explain to us, in a very pithy manner, that the Marine Corps had been formed to protect the river approaches to the Isle. There had been frequent attempts, by the city refugees, to cross the Swale by boat. For this purpose, the Marine Corps had developed a number of strategies. An assortment of craft had been assembled to undertake missions. As we were speaking, nosing out from underneath one of the dilapidated wooden piers was a craft which we could not have believed had we not seen it. Barnacle, spotting our interest, we would have said, concern, not interest, went straight into an explanation of the gunboat's mission. For indeed, it was a gunboat, as the precariously mounted Stokes mortar at the bow testified.
In between listening to Barnacle extolling the vessel's virtues, we were wondering where the mortar had come from.
It was archaic, yes, but this was the most advanced piece of kit we had yet seen on Sheppy. As to the vessel it had been mounted on, this was a clinker-built boat of unknown age and probably started its life as a ship's lifeboat.
That, though, had been many years ago.
Its planking was worm-eaten and rotten.
In consequence, the thwarts were near to collapse. Consequently, it was not at all seaworthy, or for that matter riverworthy. Unbelievably, it floated.
Barnacle explained that the boat had been named Dreadnought. It was rowed by a mixture of one-time seamen, who should have known better, and older sea cadets, resplendent in their uniforms.
Whilst Barnacle was still talking, the crowd on the waterfront became still.
Everyone had realized a sortie was being made from the river against the opposite bank. The place chosen was just outside the defensive perimeter of the bridge, which we had come through earlier in the day. Rubber dinghies could be seen floating at the water's edge along the opposite bank.
There were people climbing into them in an attempt to reach the isle. The dreadnought was being used as a first response unit.
Dreadnought by then was approaching the center of the river, and we could see that the mortar was being prepared for firing. There was a huge bang followed by a whoosh as the mortar bomb was launched. It could be seen lazily making its way to the opposite bank from where a muffled explosion was eventually heard.
It landed in the marsh, well beyond its intended target.
However, its purpose was achieved. Those trying to get across swiftly made for cover, to much cheering from the Queenborough side.
There was no happy ending for the dreadnought.
The boat's already weakened timbers had failed to withstand the recoil effect of the mortar being fired.
The hull had disintegrated. There were a few planks and other flotsam on the water.
It seemed, though, that all the crew had survived to fight another day.
A rescue rib had been sent to bring them in. They eventually arrived back on shore bedraggled, but not disheartened.
Barnacle was giving them a pep talk as we said our goodbyes. Ricky and I remounted the motorcycle and sped off to our next destination just outside Queenborough. This place, known as Barrow Hill, had activity on the slope facing the river crossing. This had intrigued us earlier, as had the great plume of smoke at the back. Making our way out of Queenborough, passing again the site of the Norman Castle but also the railway station.
The station was becoming overgrown as there had been no trains for a long time. We quickly came to Barrow Hill, and this name was a name to be conjured with. It indicated a long history of settlement on the isle.
Originally the hill had been, perhaps, constructed as a Bronze Age burial site. Now though, as it commanded an excellent panorama over the river, and the crossing place nearest the mainland, it made an ideal vantage point to mount defences. On reaching the hill from the rear, there were the still smouldering remains of a BP petrol station. This was, obviously, where the smoke, seen earlier, originated from.
We hailed the people we could see standing at the top of the hill, and we asked permission to ascend. This was granted.
The person commanding the hill, wearing the tallest stovepipe hat we had ever seen, was Lieutenant Colonel, retired, Jefferson Lincoln Buller. He was perhaps a scion of the Buller military family. News travels fast, and he knew that reporters from the popular Daily Magnet had arrived on the isle.
Old Jeff, as he was known locally, rarely missed anything. He greeted us warmly.
Old Jeff started the conversation by describing the displacements for the hill, where he was going to place his artillery pieces especially, but also, where he would be placing trenches and a redoubt. As he was speaking, mainly to Dixie, there was a curious commotion down the hill. At the bottom could be seen a number of men struggling to haul some heavy cannon up the relatively steep slope. The men were only making very slow progress.
Jeff caught our gaze.
He explained that these volunteers had been sent to the museum at Minster to collect the cannon on display at the entrance. These were to be recommissioned and placed, in such a way, as to be able to bombard the bridge in the event of a breakthrough by the mob on the far bank. Interestingly, one person was holding bags full of clothing, which had also been taken from the museum.
He reported to old Jeff, who nodded approvingly. We both looked at the contents of the bags. They were full archaic uniforms.
These, it turned out, were the uniforms of the West Kent Regiment of Yeomanry Cavalry. Old Jeff had decided that, as there was no shortage of horses on Sheppey, these uniforms would be worn by his people. It was at this time that old Jeff told us about the explosion at the BP petrol station. Apparently, a new recruit to his force had been sent there to make Molotov cocktails, but halfway through the work he was seen to be having a rest and a smoke.
The rest is history, as they say.
Old Jeff could not remember his name, but thought it might have been something like Maggot, but he could not be sure. At this juncture, it was time to end the conversation, as old Jeff was looking visibly tired and had very many tasks to complete.
We said our goodbyes and wished him luck.
We walked down the hill to where we had left the motorbike and were shortly on our way to Sheerness, the largest town on the isle. On the way to Sheerness, we noted the great number of riders on horses and the large number of dog carts. The dog carts were interesting. They were made of wood that had been repurposed, and the wheels were discarded car wheels from the local breaker's yard.
They did not look good, but they worked. All this had happened in a very short time.
It was indicative of the shortage of petrol, not least because the supermarket petrol stations had not had deliveries, and the BP station had disappeared in the explosion. Coming into Sheerness, there was a large car park attached to a supermarket.
This was directly ahead, so we thought it would be a good place to park the bike. Having parked the bike in the car park, we decided to see if anything of interest was happening in the estuary.
Getting to the top of the esplanade, we could see Southend across the water, but something else caught our attention. A short distance from the shore, there was a lot of activity around some closely grouped collection of buoys.
These were rising and falling with the swell.
It looked as though items were being salvaged. This was intriguing, so we went to the sea's edge where a group of people had collected to unload the small boats as they came to the shore.
To our surprise, we saw the remains of packing cases.
These were heavily waterlogged, but even more interesting was what they contained: explosives and weapons, a little rusty perhaps, but once cleaned, still in working order.
There were already people on the beach doing just this.
Ricky then noticed the name on one of the wooden cases: Richard Montgomery.
He asked one of the group on the beach what this meant.
It was explained to him that this was the name of the ship sunk in the estuary during World War II, after it had dragged its anchor.
Now, Ricky understood the significance of the letters ONT on the wooden case, strung under the Sheppey Bridge. The importance of this sunken ship to the defense of Sheppey became much clearer. Feeling that we had learned all we could for now, it was time to leave the beach. A visit to the town was important.
The streets were almost deserted, but in the middle of the high street was the bearded figure of a stooped, elderly man.
This man was walking with difficulty, with a cane for support. We approached him and asked what he thought of the conditions on the isle. He seemed rather vague, but pulled from his pocket a large hunter watch, on which were the initials CD.
He answered, eventually, by saying that he was waiting to meet a long-lost friend, but the seriousness of the present situation must have delayed him. Asking the name of this friend, he answered, Magwitch. Ricky and I realized immediately who he was waiting for. We did not have the heart to tell the old boy that his friend, quite literally, had gone up in smoke during an explosion of his friend's own making.
Leaving the old fellow to his thoughts, we made our way back to the bike. This was still where we had left it. Nothing had been touched.
It was time to go to Harty Ferry to see if there was anything afoot there. Leaving Sheerness along the road to a place named Halfway to where, we knew not, however, we passed what we assumed to be the scrap yard that the dogcart wheels had come from, and, judging by the crowd outside, it was still doing a roaring trade. Reaching the crossroads at Halfway, a few minutes from Sheerness, we turned left onto the road for Minster. It was from the museum here that the Barrow Hill cannons and uniforms had been removed. We found that when we reached the top of Minster Hill, all traffic, mainly horses and carts, was being diverted to the right along the Scockles Road. From inside the village, and quite near, we could hear the sounds of explosions. This, we later discovered, were the holiday camps at Minster Cliffs being demolished. The explosives, no doubt, had come from the Richard Montgomery. Coming to the T-junction with the Laysdown Road, we turned left for East Church and Laysdown. We continued to speed along until we reached the first of two roundabouts. At the first roundabout, the first exit led to East Church Village. The place seemed quiet, so we decided to continue on the Laysdown Road. Then we came to the second roundabout. The first exit, again, led only to East Church Village. Straight ahead went to Laysdown and to the right, to the Sheppey Prisons Complex.
Thinking there would be nothing of interest there, we decided to go straight ahead to connect with the Harty Ferry Road.
This was a right turn between East Church and Laysdown. Harty Ferry was the next nearest crossing point to the mainland, and once had a regular ferry service.
We needed to see what activity was happening there.
We were going at a fast speed along the road when, to our amazement, we saw an old biplane in the sky ahead, early 20th century by the look of it. After wheeling toward us, It came in very low and waggled its wings in greeting. Clearly the pilot, and observer who was in the nacelle, knew who we were, and were pleased to see us. There must have been enough of the Short Brothers' workshop and aerodrome left on the prison site, where the factory had been situated, to start building aircraft again. Obviously, Sheppy was creating an air force to add to its army and navy. Eventually, reaching and turning right at the Harty Ferry Road junction, we increased our speed, although the road was relatively narrow.
We were conscious of the time. We had been on Sheppy since early morning, and there was a deadline to meet for tomorrow's paper. Heading directly for the riverfront, we were immediately aware of the bustling activity all around.
It was feared that an attempt would be made by some of the crowd on the Faversham side to cross over. The commander of the Sheppy Navy at Harty Ferry needed to reassure those in the Sheppy defense hierarchy that he was up to the job. The person in command turned out to be none other than a local priest, the Right Reverend Canon Ball. After he had introduced himself, Ricky and I looked at each other and could not resist a smile. Before us stood a rotund little man, wearing a cassock, and incongruously, a yachting cap on his bald head.
His head was round, complexion ruddy, and, as it was a warm day, he was sweating profusely. Like the others, he was pleased to see us.
To prevent the invasion from Faversham, the volunteers had just launched from the slipway their flagship vessel Vanguard.
At first it was difficult to make out just what it was. Then I called to mind the mirror dinghy from the 1960s, and this was one. A historic boat sponsored, at that time, by our main rival the Daily Mirror. As it hit the water, the sails were smartly raised. With a following wind, off the Vanguard went.
Getting near to the Faversham shore, Vanguard cruised along the bank in a threatening manner, before returning and tying up alongside the Harty jetty.
Those on the far shore had nothing with which to reply, the standoff continued.
What the Faversham side did not know was that the Vanguard's cannon had not been mounted, so, an attempt at capture by the Faversham crowd would probably have been successful.
We had seen enough to know that Harty Ferry was secure and in good hands. We said our farewells and left the priest, whose motto we had just seen stenciled on the back of his cassock, "Praise God and pass the ammunition." We left him berating his sailors for failing to mount the cannon on the boat before setting off. Retracing our route across the isle, we quickly came to the Sheppy Bridge. We noticed that there was further activity on the water. We then saw that Barnacle Bill had managed, following the sinking of the dreadnought, to get another boat on the river.
The mortar had been salvaged from the riverbed and remounted on the new craft.
This new boat seemed a little more watertight than the dreadnought. Some metal plating had been fitted on the hull to give the boat better protection.
For a reason, best known to the locals but not revealed to us, this new craft had been named the Merrimack.
Apparently the name had been suggested by old Jeff.
We kept a careful eye on what the Merrimack was doing, as by this time, it was approaching the center of the river. It was getting ready to fire a salvo of mortar bombs at the far shore.
The people on board were fussing around at the bow, and eventually they seemed to get the mortar loaded. They then withdrew to the stern of the boat.
Carried on the wind, we heard the voice of Barnacle Bill shout the word fire.
Bill, we were told, had decided to command the boat in person.
Just as the mortar fired, a strong gust of wind blew along the river.
This was unfortunate as the bomb was just leaving the mortar barrel.
This caused the Merrimack to roll heavily and the bomb to travel in a quite unexpected direction.
Where it landed could never have been predicted. We were pleased that we had been watching the travel of the bomb, as it was now heading directly for the center of the bridge. We very quickly took what cover we could. There came an enormous explosion.
When we looked over the packing cases, which Ricky and I were cowering behind, we saw a huge gap in the bridge. The mortar bomb had exploded directly above the demolition explosives that had been placed underneath.
This was a disaster for us as we needed to get across to the other side.
The deadline for the next day's Daily Magnet was 11 p.m. and it was now just after 7. Glancing over what remained of the bridge railing, we saw the Merrimack with Barnacle Bill at the helm, scuttling back to Queenborough. Ali Sloper was in the water and swimming toward the Sheppy shore.
Looking back to where the motorbike had been parked, we saw a young woman. The woman came across and introduced herself as Florrie.
She told us she was the person who had made the telephone call to the Daily Magnet's office.
She was pleased that she had done so. Having introduced herself, she rushed off and back into the crowd, leaving Ricky and I to scratch our heads wondering why. However, we had no time to pursue her, so let the matter rest. The question now was how to get off the aisle.
The explosion had caused a very wide gap, far too long to be spanned using wood planking.
Then, Dixie thought of a possible solution.
In her younger days, Dixie had been a keen motorcyclist and had followed the exploits of Evel Knievel.
He had momentous motorcycle achievements which included canyon jumps and much more.
These had enthralled Dixie and she had studied his techniques. Ricky gave way to her superior knowledge and gave her the bike key. Ricky climbed on the pillion. A pathway was cleared through the crowd, and metaphorically, keeping her fingers crossed for luck, she revved the motorbike. Getting a good run into the bridge incline was important, so Dixie carefully judged the distance. Once they got to know of Dixie's attempt, all rubble and debris cluttering the remains of the bridge was cleared by the crowd. She moved off, slowly at first, and stayed in the center of the road.
Gradually increasing speed, she could feel the power of the bike pulsating through her. It was an exhilarating feeling, one that she had not experienced in a long time.
She reached the lip of the yawning gap, then, she felt the front wheel leaving the road, quickly followed by the back. There was no longer any traction, and she, Ricky, and the bike were flying through the air.
Dixie had calculated everything exactly.
The back wheel touched down on the mainland side of the bridge, fractionally before the front, a perfect landing. Speeding through the assembled crowd, which parted at her approach, she dexterously wended her way through the stationary vehicles.
It was not long before she and Ricky were on their way back to London.
On the main London road there was little traffic, and they reached the Blackwall Tunnel in less than an hour. They were back in the Daily Magnet's offices, with time to spare, to meet tomorrow's copy deadline. Rupert Maxwell was overjoyed to see Dixie, and he congratulated her on the scoop. He also praised Ricky and said that he was no longer the office gopher but a fully fledged junior reporter.
This was no time for self-congratulation. There was a story to write and a paper to put to bed.